Chapter 29. It was raining Monday morning when I woke up. The first rain we'd had in weeks, and the farmers were happy even if the vintners were not. I knew at least one vintner who had bigger problems than heavy rain. As I dressed, I listened to the radio and heard that a hurricane named Jasper was off the coast of Virginia, causing unsettled weather conditions as far north as New York's Long Island. I was glad I was driving back to Manhattan today. I hadn't been to my 72nd Street condo in over a month, and I hadn't accessed my answering machine messages either, partly because I didn't want to, but mostly, I guess, because I forgot my access code. Anyway, at about 9 a.m., I went downstairs dressed in designer jeans and polo shirt and made coffee. I was sort of waiting for Beth to call or come by. The local weekly was on the kitchen counter, unread from Friday, and I was not too surprised to see last Monday's murder on the front page. I took the paper out on the back porch with a mug of coffee and read the local hotshot reporter's version of the double murder story. The guy was imprecise enough, opinionated enough, and was a bad enough stylist to write for Newsday or the Times. I noticed an article about Tobin Vineyards in which Mr. Frederick Tobin was quoted as saying, "We will begin the harvest any day now, and this promises to be a vintage year, perhaps the best in the last 10 years, barring a heavy rain." Well, Freddy, it's raining. I wondered if condemned men are allowed to request wine with their last meal. Anyway, I threw the local weekly aside and picked up Emma's gift, The Story of Pirate Treasure. I flipped through it, looked at the pictures, saw a map of Long Island, which I studied for a minute or so, then found the chapters on Captain Kidd and read at random a deposition of Robert Livingston Esquire, one of Kidd's original financial backers. The deposition read, in part, that hearing Captain Kidd was come into these parts to apply himself unto His Excellency, the Earl of Bellamont, the said narrator came directly from Albany, ye nearest way through the woods, to meet the said Kidd here and wait upon his lordship. And at his arrival at Boston, Captain Kidd informed him there was on board his sloop then in port 40 bales of goods and some sugar, and also said he had about 80 pound weight in plate. And further, the said Kidd said he had 40 pound weight in gold, which he hid and secured in some place in the Sound betwixt this and New York, not naming any particular place, which nobody would find but himself. I did a little math in my head and figured that 40 pounds of gold would be worth about $300,000 on the hoof, so to speak, not counting whatever historical value or numismatic value it would have, which could easily quadruple the value according to what Emma had said. I spent the next hour reading, and the more I read, the more I was convinced that nearly every narrator in this episode, from Lord Bellamont to the lowest seaman, was a liar. No two stories were alike, and the value and amount of the gold, silver, and jewels were all over the lot. The only thing everyone agreed on is that treasure had been put ashore in various spots around the Long Island Sound. Not once was Plum Island mentioned, but what better place to hide something? As I'd learned on my trip to Plum, the island had no harbor then, so it was unlikely to be visited by random ships looking for food or water. It was owned by white settlers and therefore off limits to Indians, but was apparently uninhabited by anyone. And if Kidd dropped off a valuable treasure with John Gardner, a man he didn't know, why wouldn't he sail the 5 or 6 miles across the bay to Plum Island and bury more treasure there? It made sense to me. I wondered, though, how Frederick Tobin had figured it out. He would be happy to tell us at his press conference when he announced his discovery. He'd probably say, "Hard work, a good knowledge of viniculture, perseverance, and a superior product. And good luck." Anyway, I dawdled on the back porch for a long time, reading, watching the weather, working the case in my mind, waiting for Beth, who I thought should have arrived by now. Finally, I went inside through the French doors that led to the den and played the 7 messages on my answering machine. Number 1 was from Uncle Harry, saying he had a friend who wanted to rent the house, so would I mind buying it or leaving? 2, Detective Lieutenant Wolf, who said simply, "You're pissing me off." 3, Emma's old unplayed message a little before midnight on Friday, just saying hello. 4, Max on Saturday morning with the particulars on the Tobin party and saying he had a nice chat with Beth and would I call him. 5, Dom Finelli, who said, "Hey, Paisano, you missed a good time. What a night. The wine was flowing. We picked up 4 Swedish tourists at Taormina's, 2 of them airline stewardesses, 1 model, 1 actress. Anyway, I called a friend, Jack Rosen, at the Daily News, and he's going to do a story on your return to New York after convalescing in the country. Wounded hero comes home." Beautiful. Give him a call Monday, a.m., and the story will run Tuesday, so the humps at Police Plaza can read it before they bust your cojones. Am I good or what? Call me Monday, and we'll have a drink, p.m., and I'll tell you about the Swedes. Ciao. I smiled. 4 Swedes, my ass. 6 was Beth on Sunday morning asking where I'd disappeared to Saturday night and when we could meet. And 7 was Beth on Sunday afternoon acknowledging my message to her office and saying she'd be at my house on Monday morning. So when the doorbell rang a little before noon, I wasn't too surprised to see Beth there. I said, "Come in." She left her umbrella on the porch and came in. She was wearing another tailored suit, this one sort of a rust color. I thought I should say I was alone, so I said, "I'm alone." She said, "I know." We looked at each other for some very long seconds. I knew what she was going to say, but I didn't want to hear it. She said it anyway. "Emma Whitestone was found in her house by one of her employees this morning. Dead. Apparently murdered." I said nothing. What could I say? I just stood there. Beth took my arm and led me into the living room to the couch. "Sit down," she said. I sat. She sat beside me and took my hand. She said, "I don't know how you feel. I mean, I know you must have been fond of her." I nodded. For the second time in my life, I wasn't the one giving the bad news. I was the one hearing about the murder of someone I cared about. It was mind-numbing. I couldn't quite grasp it because it didn't seem real. I said to Beth, "I was with her until about 10 last night." Beth said, "We have no time of death yet. She was found in her bed, apparently killed by blows to the head with a fireplace poker that was found on the floor. There was no sign of forced entry. The back door was unlocked." I nodded. He would have had a key, which he never returned, and she never thought to change the lock. He knew there was a poker handy. Beth continued, "There was the appearance of a burglary. Pocketbook emptied, cash gone, jewelry box emptied, that sort of thing." I took a deep breath and said nothing. Beth then told me, "Also, the Murphys are both dead. Apparently also murdered." My God. Beth said, "A Southold PD was patrolling their street about once an hour and was keeping an eye on the Murphy house, but he didn't see anything." She added, "When a new shift came on at 8 a.m., the officer noticed that the newspaper was on the lawn and it was still there at 9. He knew that the Murphys rose early and took the paper in. So, she asked me, "Do you want to hear this?" "Go on." "Okay. So he phoned them, then knocked on the front door, then went around back and saw that the rear door in the Florida room was unlocked. He went inside and found them in their bed. Both had died of apparent head injuries caused by a crowbar that he found on the floor with blood on it." She added, "The house was ransacked. Also, with the police presence on the street, it's assumed that the house was approached from the bayside." I nodded. Beth said, "You can imagine the Southold PD is in a state of uproar, and the whole North Fork will soon be. If they get one murder a year, that's a lot." I thought of Max. who liked things quiet and peaceful. Beth continued, "The county PD is sending a task force because now the thinking is that this is a psychotic who burglarizes houses and murders the occupants." She added, "I think that whoever killed the Gordons could have taken the Murphy's key from the Gordon house, and that's why there was no forced entry and why the back door was unlocked." She added, "That would indicate some premeditation." I nodded. Tobin knew he might have to get rid of the Murphys at some point and thought ahead far enough to take the key. When Beth mentioned that the Murphy's key was not found in the Gordon house, that should have alerted us. Another example of underestimating the killer. I said, "We should have predicted." She nodded. "I know." She continued, "As for Emma Whitestone, well, either she left her door unlocked or again, someone had the key. Someone she knew." I looked at Beth and saw that we both knew who she was talking about. "In fact," she said, "I had that surveillance put on Frederick Tobin Sunday morning, as you suggested, and it ran all day, but some higher-ups called it off from midnight to 8. For budgetary reasons. So basically no one was watching Tobin after midnight." I didn't respond. She said, "I had trouble getting them to agree to any surveillance of Tobin. He's just not a suspect." She said pointedly, "I didn't have anything on him to warrant around-the-clock surveillance." I was paying attention, but my mind kept returning to images of Emma at my house, swimming in the bay, at the Historical Society party, in her bedroom where she was found murdered. What if I'd spent the night there? How would anyone know that she was alone? It occurred to me that Tobin would have killed me too if he'd found me there sleeping beside her. Beth said, "By the way, I met Frederick Tobin at his party and he was very charming, but he's a little too slick. I mean, there's another side to that man. There's something not so nice right behind that smile." I thought of Frederick Tobin and pictured him talking to Emma on the lawn at his party. As he spoke to her, he must have known he was going to murder her. I wondered, though, if he decided to kill her to keep her from talking to me anymore, or if he just wanted to say, "Fuck you, Corey. Fuck you for being a wise ass. Fuck you for figuring out I killed the Gordons. Fuck you for fucking my ex-girlfriend, and just plain fuck you." Beth said, "I feel a little responsible for the Murphys." I forced myself to think about the Murphys. They were decent people, helpful citizens, and unfortunately for them, witnesses to too much that had taken place next door over the last 2 years. I said, "I brought a photo of Frederick Tobin to the Murphys on Wednesday, and they ID'd him as the guy with a white sports car. Tobin owns a white Porsche." I explained my short visit to Edgar and Agnes Murphy. Beth nodded. "I see." I said, "The murderer is Frederick Tobin." She didn't reply. I said, "He killed Tom and Judy Gordon, Edgar and Agnes Murphy, maybe that Plum Island veterinarian, and Emma Whitestone, and maybe others." I added, "I'm taking this very personally." I stood and said, "I need some air." I went out back and stood on the porch. The rain was heavier now, gray rain falling from a gray sky into a gray sea. The wind was coming off the bay from the south. Emma. Emma. I was still in the shock and denial stage, working up to the anger stage. The more I thought about Tobin bashing her head in with an iron poker, the more I wanted to bash his head in with an iron poker. Like a lot of cops who have a personal and close-up encounter with crime, I wanted to use my power and knowledge to take care of it myself. But a cop can't be a vigilante, and a vigilante can't be a cop. On the other hand, there were times when you had to put the badge away and keep the gun.